Your doctor knows a lot about your life, and so might law enforcement agencies, with the help of a man named Bob McGrew. He's a software engineer we heard yesterday on his way to work.
Hi. Hi. Small coffee, room for cream.
Will that be all for you today?
That's it.
He got a cup of coffee on his way to the office and later stopped at his bank.
There we go. $100.
Bob McGrew works for a Silicon Valley company that, among other things, sells software to the FBI and CIA. The software is meant to help the government find patterns among terrorists by spotting clues in everything from phone calls to the kind of trail that Mr. McGrew left on his way to work. In the second of two reports, NPR's Dina Temple-Raston looks at whether this technique works.
So yesterday, we told you that Bob McGrew was not a terrorist. We looked at whether the government could protect his privacy, even if it had snooped on him on the way to work. Today, for our purposes, Bob's not quite so innocent. So just for a second, let's assume you're a terrorist suspect.
Okay.
McGrew's simple yet sinister morning errands would have left traces in at least three places: at Starbucks, at his credit card company, and at his bank. And if he was a suspected terrorist, the government is allowed to scoop up those and other records as a way to track him down or to see who he's associating with. It's called data mining. Now, in real life, Bob McGrew is actually trying to help find terrorists. He works at Palantir Technologies.
All right, so here we are at Palantir. Now we'll just take the elevator up to the third floor.
Palantir, named for the all-seeing stones in the Lord of the Rings series, helps investigators fuse enormous amounts of data and then look for connections. Think of it like the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon game. Start with a suspect or a terrorist organization.
Hezbollah, the so-called party of God, is commonly thought of as being Israel's problem.
This is from one of Palantir's demonstration videos.
Closer analysis, however, reveals Hezbollah as an organization with truly global reach and a long history of attacking U.S. interests.
Say you're an analyst who wants to figure out how Hezbollah is financed. A couple of mouse clicks and the software trolls through databases.
We find that entities linked to Hezbollah through payments include 13 nations, 9 terrorist organizations, 5 people, 2 charities.
The names appear on the screen. Then there are links so analysts can get more information. Click on a map icon, and the software puts the names on a Google map of Lebanon, showing where they lived. The map shows that two of the financiers were neighbors. Now, disembodied voice aside, you get the idea. That's how it's supposed to work if you start with a specific target in mind. The harder problem is whether this approach can find a bad guy no one has already suspected was a terrorist.
That's really a fool's errand.
Jim Dempsey is the executive director of the Center for Democracy and Technology, a privacy group in San Francisco.
There had been, over the past 7 years, this sense that if you collect more and more data and put it into a powerful enough computer, shake it and bake it the right way, you'll come up with the unknowns.
So far, that hasn't happened.
Terrorists, they're entrepreneurial, and that's what makes fighting terrorism tricky.
That's Alex Karp, Palantir's CEO. What he means by that is terrorists don't behave in predictable ways. Fred Kate of Indiana University's Cybersecurity Center explains.
We don't even have enough of a data set to get a good pattern of what does a terrorist look like. And terrorists, of course, are constantly changing their patterns. And the other sort of big difference here from sort of non-terrorism data mining, terrorists don't want to get caught.
Kate says because terrorists don't want to get caught, they avoid patterns. They use one-time cell phone numbers and Dropbox addresses. So while data mining might help spot fraud on eBay, terrorism is a tougher challenge. Late last year, the National Academy of Sciences came to the same conclusion. It said basically that so little is known about how terrorists operate, analysts wouldn't spot a pattern, even if there was one. Still, the New York Police Department, the FBI, and the CIA think Palantir is not on a fool's errand and may have found a way around that problem. Dina Temple-Raston, NPR News.
And we're going to shrink that space between professional and amateur a little more now with the help of Keith Jenkins, NPR's multimedia director. Hiya.
Hi, how are you?
There are obviously lots of different cameras on the market these days for various budgets and various skill levels, and we've asked you to pick three that best represent that range. Let's start with small and easy.
Well, small and easy is the range that most people are going to have already. It's called a cell phone, and most of these cell phones now come with cameras. We're looking at the newest iPhone, the iPhone 3GS, mm-hmm. which has a 3-megapixel camera. And one of the neat features about this is that it is autofocus. And autofocus for something this tiny is something that a lot of people have been hoping for in this camera. And what that allows you to do is actually to select the area of the photograph that you want to be in focus. So you touch a spot on the screen and it snaps that into focus.
That's what you can do. What can't you do with the camera?
Well, you know, this camera is not going to take great sporting event pictures. It's not going to take great pictures in low light. And, you know, if you want a really stunning portrait with the background softly out of focus, you're probably not going to be able to get this with that either.
How does the iPhone, by the way, compare with other cell phone cameras out there?
This one is comparable, but there are some that are better. Nokia, Sony, Ericsson make cameras with much more detail and depth. But for the convenience of the iPhone and the size, it's really pretty much right in the middle of the pack. And the newest version also has video.
Okay, moving up a level, what do you have next on the as we move up the camera ladder here?
Well, the next camera is what you used to call a point-and-shoot camera. It's got a broad definition now. This one is the Canon G10, and you can indeed turn it on, mm-hmm. point it at somebody, and take a picture.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you can do a lot more with this camera. It's got enough control on it that you can adjust the aperture, you can adjust the depth of field, you can adjust the shutter speed. So if you do want to use this for sports, it's possible. If you want to use this for nice portraits, you can do that as well.
So there are purposes for which this camera, and that's a Canon that you brought here, that would be appropriate, and the cell phone would not be up to the task.
That's true. That is correct. And this offers you more. It's bigger. You have to maybe invest in a case to keep it in one piece, especially if you're going to be running around the beach or the mountains. But this also offers much greater control, much greater sharpness in your pictures.
How many hours do I have to spend reading the manual to learn how to work?
Reading the manual. Well, for the cell phone, probably not very many.
Right.
For the Canon, I would invest in at least 45 minutes. A lot of these cameras come with little pictograms which tell you what to do in certain situations, but now there are so many of them that the manual is probably the best place and maybe the only place to find out a good definition of what all of them mean.
Okay, let's get more ambitious and more costly in our camera choices. You've brought another Canon.
Lots more costly. This Canon, which also has an equivalent on the Nikon side, what we have here is the Canon 5D Mark II. This camera not only shoots great still photographs, professional quality still photographs, but also will do HD quality video and allow for audio input. So if you want to plug in a microphone, you can do that and shoot extremely high quality video with this still digital camera.
And the prices for these three different cameras?
Well, starting at the most expensive end, the Mark II will set you back about $2,700.
Hmm.
Your Canon G10, which is the mid-range point-and-shoot, that's about $500. And an iPhone with a 2-year contract is $199.
Keith Jenkins, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
It's Keith Jenkins, who is NPR's multimedia director. And to see what the same subject looks like when photographed by these three very different cameras, you can go to our website, npr.org. One final note, whether you're hitting the beach, the backcountry, or embarking on a tranquil staycation, we would like to see your vacation photos. Over the coming weeks, we'll collect the best vacation shots and put them in a gallery on the website, adding to it through the end of the summer. You'll find directions on how to get your pictures to us, as well as Keith's 10 tips for taking better photos, also at npr.org.
And for years, the government has collected information on ordinary Americans. The FBI and others are allowed to look at phone records, emails, bank withdrawals, and more. The purpose, especially since 9/11, is to prevent a terrorist attack. The problem It's impossible to vacuum up phone records and other personal information on millions of people without violating someone's privacy. There may be no perfect balance between preventing terrorism and protecting privacy, but a software company in Silicon Valley claims to have a partial fix. In the first of two reports, NPR's Dina Temple-Raston visits the engineer who helped write the new software.
Bob McGrew looks like a surfer. He's wiry and blonde with his hair pushed to the side of his forehead. We met one recent morning in Palo Alto so I could visit Palantir Technologies. That's the Silicon Valley company where McGrew is the chief engineer. McGrew's commute is actually a walk. He lives just 10 minutes from the office. So we made a couple of routine stops along the way.
Hi. Hi. Small coffee, room for cream.
Will that be all for you today?
That's it.
Did you want any pastry or that?
No, thanks.
We waited for the cashier to swipe his credit card, and then off we went to a nearby ATM.
There we go. $100.
And what might seem like two perfectly innocuous stops could, in a terrorism investigation, turn into something more. They're points in a data trail, something all of us leave in our wake every day.
What kind of information would have been collected on you so far this morning?
Well, Starbucks would know that I purchased a coffee from them. My credit card company would know the amount of the purchase. And my bank is going to know that I have taken out money from the ATM.
So in the span of about 10 minutes, Bob McGrew left quite a trail, which might be useful to investigators if he's a terrorist. But what if he's not a terrorist? How is his privacy protected?
Suppose, since I'm actually not a terrorist, at some point they'll find out that I'm actually innocent. At that point, you want the same software that's protecting authorized use to then say, no, you no longer have access to this information.
When investigating terrorism, the government can get its hands on all kinds of personal information. The rules are a little murky, but generally the FBI, with a warrant, can collect data on people inside the United States. The CIA and the National Security Agency mainly focus overseas, but even they can look at people in this country. Fred Kate, the director of Indiana University's Cybersecurity Center, explains it this way.
For example, right now, it is perfectly legal, without any question, for the government to collect every telephone call, every email, every communication in the world, as long as it can claim credibly that some part of the communication involves a person outside of the United States.
It's relatively easy to get swept up in a government information grab. If you're a terrorist suspect, you might be in their sights. Or if you have even a slight connection to a suspect, you could end up in the net too. Privacy advocates also worry about the misuse of personal information. In Massachusetts, law enforcement officials searched for information on Patriots quarterback Tom Brady. So they looked up his address, whether he was a gun owner. They were just curious. They did this 968 times. Bob McGrew says what happened to Tom Brady couldn't have happened if law enforcement was using his company's software.
When some of these officials were looking at Tom Brady's data, that's all captured in a log.
What's new here is that the software clearly identifies who is looking at private information. McGrew says that means the accountability is built right in. That's an important claim, given that the FBI and CIA, among others, have started using Palantir software in recent months. Now, technology alone is no silver bullet. It's just a tool. And rules for using this powerful tool need to be beefed up, according to former FBI agent Mike German.
There has to be intensive oversight, and there have to be ramifications when somebody violates the policies that are there to protect the rights of the innocent people whose information is collected.
German is now with the ACLU.
It's very unclear now what protects people's privacy once it's collected anywhere along the chain, whether it's a state and local police officer collecting it, or whether it's the FBI collecting, or whether it's the intelligence community.
Something to consider next time you buy a cup of coffee or swipe your bank card at an ATM. Dina Temple-Raston, NPR News.
Tomorrow, we have the second of our reports.
There had been, over the past 7 years, this sense that if you collect more and more data and put it into a powerful enough computer, shake it and bake it the right way, you'll come up with the unknowns. That's really a fool's errand.
Tomorrow, we look at whether data mining really helps catch terrorists.
and you thought that getting on Facebook would get you with the hip and trendy kids. Turns out the internet and social networking site show signs of aging. A study shows that more than a quarter of Facebook users are between the ages of 35 and 54. NPR's Margot Adler recently joined the site and shares her experience as a member of the older demographic.
I confess I've become overly involved with Facebook. I've done the obvious things, connected with old friends, engaged in fun, and sometimes even deep discussions after putting up a status report. I ignore the groups, the events, the gifts, the apps, and the 1,300 people I haven't friended because they didn't leave a relevant message. But a few months ago, I got an odd request. Would I join this group, Women Who Have Removed Their Birth Year from Facebook? My first reaction was, why? I'm 63, and I've always believed in being honest about my age. I love the fact that I'm old enough to have done civil rights work in Mississippi and to have covered the Pentagon Papers trial. I'm married, I'm not looking for a job, so why hide my age? But then I noticed, as I thought about it, that all the Facebook ads on my page were about wrinkle creams and diets. Whoever was advertising had focused on my age and on nothing else revealed in my profile. For example, a love of science fiction or birding. To them, I was just a fat, walking wrinkle waiting to be fixed. So I wrote a message to the woman who started the group. It turns out her name is Christine Solosky. She's 52 and she lives near Toronto. I asked her why the group. She says one afternoon she noticed the ads. They were unrelenting.
They were for, anti-wrinkle, look younger than what you are, and, you know, how do the stars do it, this type of thing. I find them annoying. I guess you could say there was no balance.
And what was the result when she took her birth year out?
There was an obvious decrease in the number of those types of ads. Now the ads were geared more towards keywords in my profile and obviously based on my interests.
I decided not to join the group. I still like my age and I'm pretty good at being oblivious to messages imploring me to shape up. But recently I started looking again and I noticed no ads for diets or wrinkle cream. Turns out you now can vote ads on Facebook up or down and even vote them out. I'm guessing a lot of people voted against those ads for wrinkle cream.
Margot Adler is one of our correspondents based in New York.
A frightening thing happened to commentator Jennifer Sharp a few days ago. She logged onto her Facebook account and got the most dreaded of all friend requests.
It was from my mother. She hadn't uploaded a profile picture yet, but it was clearly her. Female, San Francisco, friends with cousin Phil. Though I'm always happy to see her when she visits me in Santa Monica, the idea of becoming Facebook friends stopped me in my tracks. I turned to write a status update about my quandary and got 20 comments. Heidi DeRuiters was the first.
If your mom is saying, I want you to be my Facebook friend, then you know what? Deal with it.
When I'd called to ask her to elaborate on the comment she'd left, she explained that she loved being friends with her mother and had even helped set up her profile.
I learned the cutest things about her because she just attacked that profile, filling in her favorite TV shows, her favorite movies. She was like, oh, the barefoot Contessa.
But the idea of finding my mother's Facebook page cute made me uncomfortable.
Maybe if you were like 22 or something, I could imagine not wanting to friend your mom.
But at the age of 40.
That's right.
Yes, 40. To Sarah Kane, I was laboring over a non-issue. And to Nicole Eisenman, who'd rejected her father's request, it was no big deal to just hit the ignore button.
Because of the whole unrequited love thing, you could actually ignore your parents and they'll understand.
I thought about my audience of 500 friends and wondered if my mother's presence would hinder my performance. If there were anyone who would detect inauthenticity in my self-packaging, it would be her.
She's going to look at it all the time.
Dorothy Bourgeois suggested I make my mother read my teenage diaries as a way of scaring her out of Facebook friendship. Then she explained that she looks at her 16-year-old son's page every day.
It's horrifying. It's the energy I would expend to, like, virtually stalk a boyfriend I have now put into my son.
The longer I left my mother's friend request dangling, the more guilt I felt glancing past it. Sandra Sharp, confirm or ignore. I was veering towards offering her a restricted access friendship when the phone rang and it was her.
I noticed
that you're on Facebook now.
Oh, my God. Yeah, Ximena made me do it.
Since caving into peer pressure and joining Facebook, she'd experienced nothing but guilt and anxiety. She felt accosted by friend requests, comments, and even the friend suggestions Facebook was automatically generating out of her address book.
There are all of these faces that are now there, and I feel rude not to accept all of them. I don't feel free to say no to anybody, but I don't really want to be your Facebook friend.
The next morning, I returned to her friend request and paused before hitting the ignore button.
No guilt. No guilt.
Watching her name vanish from the screen, I felt both courageous and cowardly, but I knew I had averted disaster. Because if I had accepted her as a Facebook friend, my father couldn't have been far behind.
Jennifer Sharp lives in Santa Monica, California. By the way, since Jennifer told us about her dilemma and its solution, we learned that there is an entire website devoted to the very subject. Naturally, it's called MyParentsJoinedFacebook.com.